everyone. It's your host, Polly Siegel. And for anyone who doesn't know me, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, certified addiction specialist, and master level trained mindfulness practitioner. I own a counseling practice in both Colorado and Illinois, and I specialize in trauma, OCD, and anxiety. If you live in either of those two states, feel free to reach out to me for a consultation and we can begin the therapeutic journey together. Now on to the good shit. Welcome to season 3 of Shit Talking Shrinks. Gosh, I'm so excited. I will be featuring experts in the healing space, and we're discussing a variety of mental health topics, the human experience, and society at large, while creating levity along the way. Get ready to laugh, learn a lot, and change your life for good. Hello, everyone. Another episode of Shit Talking Shrinks, and this one has been building. It has been a long one coming. I've waited a while to have the privilege to speak with Annie Fenn, and I want to introduce this magical guest. So today we have Annie Fenn. She's a physician, a chef, and the author of The Brain Health Kitchen, which is a science-based cookbook to better care for your brain. And what I love about it so much is that when we talk about food and we talk about the variety of diets, it's always about weight and it's always about changing just your body. And that's not, I think, really what food is solely about. Food is medicine. Food can be healing. And I think when it comes to the brain, we need to be conscious of which foods support our brain and which foods might lead to struggle in the brain. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is, Polly. It's such a pleasure to be here. And yes, that's exactly how I think about food. I think about food as medicine. I think about nourishing the brain with the right foods, and then the rest takes care of itself. I almost never really focus on weight or calories or fat grams. I think about food in terms of food groups, because that's where the science is. The science is showing us that there are certain food groups that are neuroprotective, that can reduce our risk of Alzheimer's and dementia later. And there are other foods that actually accelerate cognitive decline. And that's where the money is when it comes to the research.
I want listeners to know what we're honing in on is really what foods lead to cognitive decline and maybe brain deterioration, and which foods are really supportive to our cognitive sharpness and ability to thrive. So just first and foremost, tell us about your work and your research and how you even got to writing your cookbook.
Oh, sure. So I'm an MD. I trained as an obstetrician gynecologist, and I live in Jackson, Wyoming. So I moved here after training in Chicago. I was there for 8 years, medical school, residency. I moved to Jackson to start a medical practice, which I did for 20 years. And in the last 8 years of that practice, I was focused exclusively on menopausal medicine. And this is when I started getting interested in the brain, because all of my patients were coming in complaining of menopausal symptoms, but not the ones that you would expect. They're mostly worried about cognitive symptoms, like not remembering things they thought they should remember, or not being able to retrieve a word that is at the tip of the tongue. And so I started to really think about the impact of hormones in women on brain function. And then fast forward a couple years, I decided to retire from medicine for a couple of different reasons, but primarily because I had this other thing I really wanted to do. I wanted to go to culinary school. I had always been a home cook ever since I was a kid. I'd been cooking extensively, and I was really fascinated by how certain cultures age really successfully and how it was rooted in the way they eat and the way they live their lives. And I had seen this in my own practice. I saw that the people with, you know, healthy diets, healthy lifestyle that includes exercise and good sleep, they actually did better during surgery. They did better with their pregnancies. They did better during menopause. You know, across the board, they just were aging more healthfully. So I went to culinary school, and then I came back and I started teaching healthy cooking in my community. This was around 2012. I started seeing a lot of papers coming out of the medical journals linking a brain healthy dietary pattern to the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. And the studies were getting so solid and the evidence was building. And I thought that this was just such an important thing for everyone to know about. And nobody was talking about this, especially like not in 2012. this was around the same time my own mother was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, which turned out to be an early form of Alzheimer's. So putting all those pieces together, it wasn't too difficult for me to see the path ahead of me as very clearly that I should use my medical degree, my love of cooking, you know, my ability to teach people how to cook and access healthy food. So that's why I launched the Brain Health Kitchen as a cooking school first, to really just help teach people and spread awareness about taking care of their brains.
And, you know, as someone in my 30s, I think a lot of us, I don't know if being in your 30s makes you a youngster anymore, but I'm just going to tell myself I'm still very young. I think we think of cognitive decline as something that is only affecting, you know, people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. My hunch here is that we need to be prepping our brains in our 20s and our 30s.
It's true. And I love talking to young adults, which is between the ages of 20 and 40 is the way it's described in studies. I love talking to young adults about brain health. You know, to be honest, most of the data that we have is focused on people at midlife, those between the ages of, say, 45 and 65. And those midlife decades are quite crucial in terms of how you conduct your life, what you eat, whether or not you exercise, smoke, how you sleep. All of those things impact whether you get dementia decades later. The young adult age group hasn't been very well studied, but we're starting to see more studies that as young adults, it's really important to lay down those healthy habits. So by the time you get to midlife, you are, you know, cruising in to, you know, the type of life that will really help your brain thrive and be very resistant and resilient to any of the effects of Alzheimer's disease.
For anyone who doesn't know what cognitive decline means or these diagnoses, what is it if you can define it?
Oh, sure. So dementia is an umbrella term, so to speak. Dementia means cognitive decline, where there is impaired thinking and memory skills that is noticeable to the person and impacts their daily living. So dementia can be from many things. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia. 70% of all dementias is Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's is a particular disease that has certain criteria and has a pathological hallmark, meaning if you look at the brain of people who have had Alzheimer's, you'll see certain plaques and tangles, certain protein buildups that is basically a highlight of the disease. That's what makes it Alzheimer's, along with the clinical picture. But there's other things that lead to dementia. People who have Parkinson's disease can have dementia late in the course of that disease. There's a large amount of people with vascular dementia. We used to call this multi-infarct dementia caused by multiple small strokes in the brain. Now we call it vascular dementia. And there's this huge overlap between Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. About half of all people with Alzheimer's also have vascular. And this just means that the blood vessels that are supplying the brain are not healthy. It's a continuation of the type of cardiovascular disease you see in the rest of the body that can lead to a heart attack or chest pain, angina, things like that. And then there are other movement disorders. There's Lewy body disorder. There's FTD, which is frontotemporal dementia, and some other ones. But a lot of times we use Alzheimer's and dementia synonymously because most of the dementia that we are seeing in the US and worldwide is from Alzheimer's disease.
And when does dementia typically present, or when does it start to show on average?
Typically with Alzheimer's, it's over the age of 60. So it's important to understand that there's two types of Alzheimer's that we talk about. One is an early onset Alzheimer's disease that affects families in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. It's a devastating early onset. It's the type of Alzheimer's that was depicted in the movie Still Alice. If anyone remembers that, based on the book by Lisa Genova about the Columbia professor who was brilliant. And at the age of 50, she starts having thinking and memory problems, and she is diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. Now, that type of Alzheimer's is very rare. It's less than 1% of all the Alzheimer's cases. So when we talk about Alzheimer's in practical terms, it is late onset. It's not really coming to light until 60s, 70s, or 80s. At the age of 65, the incidence of having Alzheimer's is around 10%. At the age of 85, it's about 50%.
Wow. So it really jumps.
It really does go up. And we are facing an epidemic of Alzheimer's in this country and worldwide. A lot of people ask me, is it the seed oils? Is it the ultra-processed food? Is it the amount of stress that we're all under? And yeah, those things are important. But the driving factor why we're seeing so many cases of Alzheimer's and dementia is that we have an aging population. And we have so many people, like the baby boomers are driving this change. We have so many people over the age of 65 now entering high-risk age groups for these types of brain disorders.
And is it just that the boomer generation was much larger than generations prior to that?
That's absolutely it. The boomer generation has affected, you know, the world in so many different ways. And now there are more people of a certain age who are at risk with Alzheimer's. But that doesn't mean it has to be that way. We have so many different ways that have scientifically proven to reduce risk and even prevent Alzheimer's. Now, when I say prevent Alzheimer's, we don't actually know exactly what causes Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of theories, and the latest one is that it is multifactorial. It is not caused by one thing. So it's not going to be as easy as developing the right drug, you know, to prevent it. But, you know, if you look at the growing trend with Alzheimer's, if you're able to piece together lifestyle factors, including nutrition, exercise, good sleep, stress mitigation, things like that, you can cut the Alzheimer's burden by about 60%. That's what the current data is showing us.
Whoa. That's a huge number.
It's huge. And that's one of the reasons I started the Brain Health Kitchen. People aren't really aware yet in 2023 that Alzheimer's is largely preventable. And maybe we're not preventing it. Maybe we're just pushing it off into later age groups. Maybe I won't get Alzheimer's until I'm 105, but I don't want to get it when I'm in my 70s, in my 80s, or in my 90s, because I'm still going to be really busy traveling, writing, working, you know, enjoying life.
I want to really like name this because I think the majority of STS listeners, you know, are in their 20s and their 30s and their early 40s. And I think we get really caught up in the now of like, well, my brain is sharp now and I'm young and I'm good and I'll worry about my health when I need to later down the road. But really, if you're wanting to be savvy and you're wanting to be smart about this, everything we're about to unpack together today is going to help you be able to have a health-filled life as you age. And when you get into your 50s and your 60s and 70s, 80s, and hopefully people live to their 90s, you want to have a sharp brain and you want to feel good and you want to be able to live the best life possible. And that's where I feel we can segue now into the food of what foods are supportive to the brain and what foods are detrimental to the brain. And I'm going to let you take over.
I would also add, I have two children who are young adults in their 20s, and they're not so concerned about getting Alzheimer's when it comes right down to it. This is not something that they are concerned about. But, you know, young adults should be concerned about this because with the number of people entering these age groups, we're all going to be dealing with family members. And here's the really good news for young people. We know now that eating this way doesn't just prevent Alzheimer's disease. It actually helps you on five different memory parameters now. So my kids may not be worried about getting Alzheimer's, but they want to do well in school. They want to kill it at work. They want to be really successful. So eating this way can improve your executive function, your processing speed, your working memory, your episodic memory. These are skills that can help you just right now in your daily life.
Thank you for saying that.
So the food. Well, we have a number of landmark studies, one of which is the MIND diet study, M-I-N-D diet study. It's a brain-specific spinoff of the Mediterranean diet. We've known for decades that people who consume a Mediterranean-style diet, they live longer, they have less heart attacks, they have less strokes, and they age with less dementia. You know, is it the red wine? Is it the, you know, fruits and vegetables? Is it the fish that they eat? Is it the olive oil? Well, it's probably just that this is also a lifestyle, not just a diet. It's an approach to eating. It's an approach to enjoying food with family and friends. Fast forward to like 2000, researchers at Rush were looking at the Mediterranean diet through the lens of brain health. And they said, well, we know that the Mediterranean diet is really good and people live long and they're super healthy and et cetera. But what if we made a brain-specific diet based on the Mediterranean diet study? And that's what the MIND diet is. And they very elegantly divided the food groups from the Mediterranean dietary pyramid into 10 brain healthy food groups and 5 food groups to limit or avoid. Now, the 10 brain healthy food groups are the basis of what we should be eating to protect our brain. And each food group made the cut into being a brain healthy food group because it already had like a pile of data to support it. For example, berries is one of the food groups in the Mind Diet study. So instead of saying eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, like you may hear with healthy eating or with a Mediterranean pattern, the Mind Diet's very specific. It says eat at least 2 servings of berries a day. This is based on studies, many of them in women over the age of 60, showing that people who consume a couple servings of berries a week, they do better on memory testing and they get less dementia as they get older. So berries was singled out as its own food group.
This is probably silly to like hone in on, but like we're talking raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, elderberries, goji berries, just anything with berries at the end.
Absolutely. But some berries are more nutritious than others. And in my book, each chapter is divided by a different brain healthy food group. So in the berries chapter, you'll see a food pyramid just for berries. And I show you which ones are the most nutritious. So there are also savory berries that you might not think about, like caper berries are really, really good for you. They're full of flavonoids, which is a bioactive substance that we can talk about if you like. In general, choose berries that are black, blue, red, deep purple. These are the ones that have more anthocyanins, which is a bioactive substance that directly promotes brain health.
Well, aren't all the berries those colors?
There are white berries, there are other types of berries, but it's more the darker the pigment, the more likely they are to have higher content. So berries is its own food group. Most people don't have any problems with that. Leafy greens is another brain healthy food group. It's a very important brain health food group based on the Mediterranean diet studies. And it has its own pile of data showing that people that eat, say, 1 generous salad a day, they age with more voluminous, healthy, vibrant brains than people that don't eat salads more than twice a month. So we already have MRI brain data showing that leafy greens contribute to brain volume with age, super important biomarker for preventing Alzheimer's disease. So in the Mind Diet, it's recommended to eat 1 cup of leafy greens a day. And that could be 1 cup raw, or if you cook them, it cooks down to about 1/2 cup. In my book, I increase these guidelines to 2 cups a day just because there's even more data now that consuming a lot of fiber in your diet is important for brain health as well. So one way I bumped up the fiber in my recommendations is to bump up the leafy green intake.
And leafy greens would be spinach, arugula, what else?
So just like the berries, the ones that are darker have more bioactive substances in them. And this would be like spinach, arugula, collard greens, watercress, kale, certainly. Lettuces are also good for you, especially if you're choosing different colored lettuces, like the red ones and the light green and the dark green. The ones that are not quite so nutritious would be things like iceberg lettuce.
Yeah, iceberg lettuce gets a lot of hate.
And it's fine. It's a lot of water, primarily fiber. It's not going to be rich in these bioactive nutrients that are directly passing the blood-brain barrier, going into the brain, acting at a cellular level to block oxidative stress and clean up amyloid protein.
I want to take a quick pause to talk about our sponsor, a company called BetterHelp. It's an online therapy platform where all the therapists are licensed and accredited professionals. It's affordable. You pay a low flat fee for therapy with your therapist, and it's convenient. Do it at your own time and at your own pace, and you can communicate with your therapist as much as you want and whenever you feel is needed. And more importantly, it's effective. Thousands of people have benefited from therapy using BetterHelp, and we're really grateful to offer all of our listeners 10% off your first month. So if you're interested in receiving therapy ASAP, click the link in our show notes and you can get started. And you get to save money.
So another really important brain healthy food group is vegetables. Everyone knows that we should be eating vegetables. Vegetables are good for you. That's like nothing new, right? But in my book, I wanted to give people a lot more information. Which vegetables are more nutrient dense? What's the best bang for your money at the supermarket? Things like that. So it's recommended in the Mind Diet that you should eat at least 1 serving of vegetables a day. In my book, I increased that to 3 cups a day based on some newer data looking at the amounts of flavonoids, the amounts of fiber, and the importance of that in a brain healthy diet as well. So 3 cups of vegetables is really not that much. 3 cups raw is akin to 1.5 cups cooked. That could be like a small serving of broccoli with your eggs in the morning, some sliced up cucumbers and radishes in your salad or grain bowl at lunch, and it could be a wedge of cauliflower with dinner. It's really not that much, but super important. The cruciferous vegetables have a particular nutrient called sulforaphanes. It's a family of nutrients that is particularly anti-inflammatory. I love it for people to choose cruciferous vegetables. This includes broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower. Kale is technically a cruciferous vegetable. Another important vegetable, well, I call it an honorary vegetable, is mushrooms. We all know mushrooms are fungi, but I call them an honorary vegetable because they're becoming very important as a neuroprotective food group. So I like people to include mushrooms as well.
You know, I love mushrooms and I love cauliflower, but they hurt my stomach. Do you find that that can be the case, that it can flare up IBS and digestive issues?
Well, that goes case by case. I'm not an expert in GI disorders to really give you any good insight into that. But I can say everything that we are learning about brain health comes from what we are learning about the gut and the gut microbiome, which are the trillions of microbiota that live in our intestinal tract. All of these gut microbiota, whether they be fungi, bacteria, or viruses, they proliferate when they see a certain food. So if you're someone who didn't grow up eating mushrooms, and then you decide at the age of 30 that you're going to start eating mushrooms because you heard Dr. Fenn talking about it as neuroprotective food, your gut does not know what to do with those mushrooms. You don't have the machinery, you know, to really digest those in a comfortable way. I see this a lot with beans and legumes. People that don't love beans, that don't eat them a lot, or maybe didn't grow up with them, they have to introduce it really slowly. And when you're introducing these foods, what you're doing is you're telling your gut that, okay, you're going to see black beans again. Here's some black beans. I'm just eating a small amount, but I want you guys to like put together an army that will be able to digest this because this is going to be a food that I introduce a lot. You know, when Michael Pollan said, vote with your fork when he was talking about food, I think about it with the gut microbiome. Okay. If you show your gut microbiome black beans, they will start to proliferate and soon there'll be a crowd there able to deal with it. If you never eat black beans or any legume or lentil or anything like that in your life, you're not going to have much support down there. And it's going to be uncomfortable to eat these foods.
Interesting. So slow introduction to them can be a way to approach some of these foods that you might not have been accustomed to as a child or throughout your development.
And, you know, a lot of us grew up on a nutrient poor diet. I know I grew up in the 70s on basically a junk food diet, processed foods, frozen dinners, things from a box. And so it took, you know, a long time as a young adult to develop, you know, the sort of the constituency, the immune system, the gut bacterial, you know, backup to really eat this way. But these food groups are important. And one thing that I'm not fond of is people eliminating food groups. And I know you have to do it sometimes for food intolerances and food allergies for sure. And certainly if you have a GI disorder, it can be tricky to introduce all of these foods. But, you know, the brain healthy diet is not just one thing. It's a system of including all of these neuroprotective foods. So we touched on berries, we touched on leafy greens, we touched on vegetables. I mentioned beans and legumes. The recommendation is 3 small servings a week. And if you're sensitive to beans and legumes, certainly just once a week would be a good thing. Another important food group is whole grains. Another is nuts and seeds. Another is fish and seafood. Another is poultry. A 9th one is extra virgin olive oil. Extra virgin olive oil is so important in Mediterranean countries. The olive oil that is consumed in these countries is fresh. It contains a lot of polyphenols. It has a perfect ratio of monounsaturated fats, which I think of as the brain-friendly fats, to saturated ones, which are not as good for our brain. And extra virgin olive oil is like the secret sauce in the Mediterranean diet. It's what helps you absorb all these nutrients from all these plant foods that you're consuming. Extra virgin olive oil is also actually called out as its own food group in the Mind Diet study.
I once was reading online that there was a trend of taking like a shot of olive oil. Is that silly?
I've read that too. And I'm not really, if that's the only way you can get your olive oil, then go for it. Okay. You will get health benefits from consuming olive oil like that. But I think it's more beneficial if you think about it as the system. You're eating all these really nutritious foods. You're cooking with olive oil at every meal. You're drizzling really good olive oil on your salads or maybe at the end of a meal after it's been cooked. So it's really fresh and the polyphenols have not been degraded by heat. And this is what helps absorb these nutrients from the food. So sure, you can do a shot. Like if you don't cook at all, you know, maybe that would be fine. It's interesting to talk about the medicinal dose of extra virgin olive oil. You know, the average consumption in a European or Mediterranean country is about a quarter cup of extra virgin olive oil a day. And in the US, it's just under 2 teaspoons. And we have data from the cardiology literature just show that the closer you can be to that quarter cup intake a day, the lower your risk of heart attack, stroke, and mortality from neurodegenerative diseases, meaning your risk of dying from something like Alzheimer's or dementia is 1/3 less if you're able to get up to a European level of consumption. Just that one change.
So really what you're saying is take a bath in olive oil, rub that shit everywhere.
If you've ever traveled to Italy, you'll notice that, well, first of all, the olive oil is really fresh. They're very picky about their olive oil. It gets harvested in the fall and it all gets consumed by the next fall. Whatever is left over, that's the olive oil that they cook with. So they have sort of 2 categories of olive oil. And this is what I do in my kitchen. And it's really easy for everyone to adopt it in your own kitchen. Have 2 varieties of olive oil. One is high-end olive oil. This is the type that would be the freshest. It has a harvest date on the bottle. It's maybe a little bit more expensive, so you're going to use it sparingly, but you're going to drizzle it on food that's already been cooked because, you know, you're paying for the polyphenols and the flavor. The polyphenols are brain nutrients that are potently anti-inflammatory, that are reducing our risks of all these diseases. And then the other olive oil I have is, I call it everyday olive oil. I get it at the grocery store. It still has a harvest date because I'm not going to buy any olive oil that doesn't show that on the label, but it's not as expensive. I cook with it. I don't worry about baking with it or heating it up to 375. It's sort of my workhorse in the kitchen. And if I want to cook something above 375, let's say I want to, you know, sear a piece of fish or fry some Brussels sprouts, and I'll use an oil with a higher smoke point, such as avocado oil or a nut oil, like pecan oil, walnut oil, macadamia nut oil.
I know you quickly went over some of the other food groups that are supportive to the brain. Nuts and poultry and fish. When it comes to nuts, what are the best nuts? What's the best fish that you recommend? And then I guess poultry is pretty self-explanatory.
You know, walnuts often have the reputation of being the brain healthiest nut. And it's true. Walnuts are great. They even look like little brains. So who could forget that? Walnuts are really high in vitamin E, the type of vitamin E that's bioavailable. Vitamin E is like a family of vitamins, and some of them you get absorbed and some of them you don't. So walnuts is a perfect vitamin E delivery system. It's also rich in monounsaturated fats. Like I mentioned, the brain healthy diet is not a low fat diet. In fact, it's actually rich in fats, brain friendly fats, but it's very low in the certain types of fats, like saturated fat. And certainly there's no trans or man-made fats in the diet whatsoever. So it's mostly monounsaturated fat with some polyunsaturated. And nuts are a perfect delivery system of that. So besides walnuts, I like cashews, almonds, pistachios, peanuts, all of these things are incredibly good for you. Macadamia nuts have a certain type of fat that you also get in olive oil called oleic acid. So macadamia, although they're expensive, if you can get them, they're also really good for you.
And then when it comes to fish, I would think like tuna, salmon, cod.
Yeah, no, you're off to a good start. Fish is complicated. I do a food pyramid for every food group in my book. The fish and seafood one was created from the point of view of which fish is going to deliver the most brain health nutrients. And we're talking about DHA and EPA, 2 of the omega-3 fatty acids. Which fish is going to be low in environmental toxins, which our oceans are full of, right? And how larger fish bioaccumulate them and have more of it. And then which fish is most sustainable for the planet? It's a low toxin, high DHA, planet-friendly look at fish and seafood. It's complicated and it's changing rapidly, but there are some things that we can say for sure. 1, if you eat at the bottom of the food chain of the ocean, then you're going to have all of those things. And this includes anchovies, sardines, mackerel, herring, all the little fish. And then the next rung of that pyramid would be wild-caught fish that is from cold water. This includes cod, wild-caught salmon, usually from Alaska, and some other flaky fish. And then above that are shellfish, bivalves, things like mussels, clams, scallops. They have a lot of brain health nutrients. They have not only DHA and EPA, they have selenium. And a lot of the shellfish are now cultivated in a very planet-friendly way. So while I'm not a fan of farmed salmon or farmed cod or farmed sea bass. I'm a huge fan of shellfish that are sustainably farmed because that is something that the technology is really getting there. And then at the very top of that pyramid, the fish that we shouldn't eat that much, maybe just as a special treat, would be things like large tuna, shark, swordfish. You know, they bioaccumulate. Grouper. Grouper can get absolutely enormous. They're eating all the stuff off of the barrier reef and they're accumulating lead and they're accumulating mercury and all sorts of things. By the time that grouper is harvested, he's going to have a lot of those toxins in his system. And that goes directly to the body. Now, the important thing about environmental toxins is that the older you get, the less likely you are to incorporate these into your brain. It's incredibly important for children, babies, pregnant women, young adults, like adolescents, to be very careful about their sources of fish. And everyone should be careful, mind you. But a young brain that is developing very rapidly tends to accumulate these toxins more and have more of a detrimental impact from them.
I would have thought that tuna would have been, you know, closer to the bottom of the pyramid, but it sounds like eat that sparingly.
It depends. Light tuna, like you get from a can, is actually on my brain healthy fish list. It's just the large tuna that are at the top. So it's a lot of this involves reading labels on cans and kind of having a working knowledge of the different fish and being willing to ask the fishmonger if you have one at your grocery store. Some of them are very knowledgeable. Also, sometimes there's some good resources too, like the Monterey Bay Aquarium app is a really good source to see what's going on in terms of what's the most sustainable fish or if there's any that should be, you know, just really be careful about.
And I know we're close to time, but if you could just give an overview of what are some of the foods that decline the brain, deteriorate the brain, or they're not supportive to overall vitality.
Oh, sure. So the MIND diet broke it down into 5 foods to limit or avoid. In my book, I added a 6th one. We can talk about that in a second. But the 5 main ones to remember are 1, fast and fried food. 2, butter. 3, cheese. 4, red meat. And 5, pastries and sweets. Now, the MIND diet researchers are not saying you should never eat butter, or you should never eat cheese, or never have a cupcake. They're saying that, you know, these foods are high in saturated fat. They're often ultra-processed. We know ultra-processed food as a group is very detrimental to brain health for both young adults and older adults, for everyone across the board, and that these should be limited or avoided in a brain-healthy diet. So they have guidelines in terms of consumption, like, for example, red meat, less than 4 servings a week. And a serving size is smaller than the average American serving size. It's under 3 ounces, which is about the size of a deck of cards. So we're looking at eating less red meat, looking for higher quality red meat when we do eat it, if we do eat it, and also just a smaller serving size. I mean, all of the brain protective diets that have been described are largely plant-based. So you don't have to be fully plant-based if you don't want to be. But if you're someone who eats everything, you know, 3/4 of your plate should be plant foods, whole grains, beans, leafy greens, vegetables. Now, if you look at these foods to limit or avoid, they have a couple things in common. They're all really high in saturated fat. And one reason that the MIND diet, I think, was able to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's in this study by 53% is because they limited these foods in their diet. And the American diet has so much butter, so much cheese, and so much red meat in it. And it's a great source of saturated fat. And we know when you eat a diet that's high in saturated fat, that raises your LDL cholesterol. LDL cholesterol, if it is high, is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So in the MIND diet, they were effectively driving down people's sat fat content in their diets, driving down their blood cholesterol. And in return, I think that was a big reason why they posted such amazing results. They slashed these people's risk by more than half after just 4.5 years with these dietary tweaks. Now, the 6th food group that I added is alcohol. Mind you, red wine was one of the 10 brain healthy food groups in the original MIND diet study. There was a follow-up MIND diet study that came out earlier this year, the MIND diet trial. In that study, they had already dropped red wine as a food group because there's just so much data coming out now that there's really no level of alcohol that is thought to be beneficial for the brain. And that there was a huge study that came out of the UK, the UK Biobank study, 36,000 participants, all of them had MRIs of their brain to follow brain volume over time. And what we found from that study is that moderate drinking, like we used to think was beneficial for brain health, we now know is actually not good for our brains. The best amount of alcohol to drink for brain health, both current and future, is nothing. And if you do choose to drink, keeping it under 4 drinks a week seems to be better than the standard moderate definition, which is 1 drink a day for women, 2 drinks a day for men. In my book, when this study came out, the same time my manuscript was going to be final, I took red wine out of the brain healthy food groups. I put it in the foods to limit or avoid. I like people to think a lot about mindful drinking. If you do choose to drink, it's very important to, you know, have some parameters around it, have some boundaries around it. You know, do it with other people. Do it when you're consuming food. Take your cues from the Mediterranean people. I spend a lot of time in Italy. People don't drink a lot of alcohol there, but when they do, they're really enjoying their food and they're always with other people. So small amounts, strategically enjoyed at the table. In the US, I see a lot of people going to happy hour and drinking maybe 3 drinks in a row without any food. You know, you don't really see that in these Mediterranean countries. It's not part of the culture. So mindful drinking, I think, is a big part of approaching a brain healthy diet.
Well, I feel really good that I don't drink, so.
I mean, just a couple years ago, doctors were of the frame of mind, based on the studies, that non-drinkers were missing out on some sort of health benefit. But now we know that non-drinking is the best thing for your brain and probably your overall health too. And light drinking is the next step. And moderate drinking, and certainly heavy drinking, is directly detrimental to brain health. So kudos to you.
It's all in my mind about harm reduction. We can't be perfect in this. We're not going to be able to be. Yeah, there's just no perfection. It's all about making choices consciously and intentionally and knowing what helps the brain and what hurts the brain and, you know, making an informed decision based on your values for your future and really the kind of life you want to build as you age. That's how I'm understanding it. And I am so thankful, Dr. Fenn, for you to join me. You've shared a wealth of knowledge. I'm sure people are going to have to re-listen and write down all of your tips and tricks because there were a million sprinkled throughout this episode. To all of the listeners, please share this with others. Brain health is just, it's imperative. It's our livelihood. It's everything to our ability to have a good life and a meaningful life. So I hope everyone enjoyed this episode and we'll catch everyone later.